Right, so let us begin with the first session of this workshop. First of all, let me thank London School of Economics, the Hellenic Observatory, plus the Department of Sociology from the University of Manchester. Thankfully, Vanessa May is today here with us from the University of Manchester, so it is a collaboration from both universities, and we are very lucky that this actually happened. The whole rationale of the workshop is actually to combine the theoretical part of social change plus concentrating on the case of the Greek example. Hopefully by combining both kind of approaches we will be able to have a more complete understanding of what is happening in terms of social change plus what is happening now in Greece. Now, it is a great pleasure for me to introduce the following speakers, beginning with Dr. Vanessa May, who is a lecturer in sociology from the University of Manchester and the Morgan Center of Study of Relationships and Personal Life at the University of Manchester. Let me begin by saying that a book of yours is forthcoming, publishing in 2013, called Connecting Self to Society, Belonging in a Changing World, which is a very interesting topic, and we're looking forward to this publication. And Vanessa, as I said, is a lecturer in sociology at the University of Manchester, and the research interests are in the field of lone motherhood, the self-belonging and methods, and this book, as I said, is forthcoming. Now, what she's going to talk about is the sense of belonging and the social change. And it's a great pleasure to have Matthew Adams from the University of Brighton with us today, who is one of the few, if not the only, to have published a book actually on social change and the self, which is something that for some reason didn't happen before, and I'm very glad that you made it here today. And Matt actually is a psychologist. He's not a sociologist or a political scientist, so we have a psychological perspective into that workshop as well. And he is teaching social, cultural, and critical psychology, and he's interested in how social structures, norms, and symbols interpretate the personal and subjective, and particularly in relation to social change. Now, the interesting thing about Matt is that he started by thinking out the issues in relation to reflexivity, and hopefully you're going to include this aspect here today as well. That would be nice. And the issues of ethics, consumption, class, and the child are also areas of his expertise. So don't let me go any further. Thank you very much, both of you, for being here today. It's your
call. Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you, Athanasia, for organising this. It's nice to be here. And even though it says it's co-organised by Manchester, but Athanasia here did all the organising, actually.
I used to be at Manchester, so that's right.
So we are former colleagues from when Athanasia was at Manchester. So it's really nice to be here, to be invited to speak, and also really nice to be on a panel with Matt, whose work I've used for a while and been a fan of. So finally I get to meet the guy as well. Right, so as Athanasia said, I'm writing in the process of finalising a book manuscript. So what I thought I'd do is do like a whistle-stop tour of not the whole book, you'll be glad to know, because otherwise we'd be here next week still, but some of the key points that might hopefully be relevant to the topic of today, which is the Greek crisis. And like Margaret Archer earlier today, I know very little about Greece, although my parents did live there for 10 years. I've never lived there myself and so on, but I have an inkling of the kind of crisis that is going on there at the moment. So this will be sort of general theory with hopefully some links to what's actually going on in Greece at the moment. So I'll kind of broadly talk about three things today. First of all, sort of telling you a bit about belonging and why I think it is a useful concept to be using in studying social change and the impacts of social change on the self. And looking at I'll switch those around now. So I'll talk about the politics of belonging first, and then depending on how much time I've left, I'll talk about the different modes or different sources of belonging as a way of getting into the kind of the complexities of social change, but also the complexities of the self, and also as a way of being able to provide quite a nuanced account of these two and how these two come together. So that's the plan. And first of all, then belonging. Now, the first question that that I think we need to start with when we're talking about belonging as a way of looking at the impact of social change on the self is, well, how do we then view, you know, how do we view self and society? And I'll lay my cards out on the table here. I'm a relational sociologist. So my perspective on both self and society is a relational one. And I've just got one quote here from one of my favourites, Norbert Elias, who's arguing that if we're looking at both individual and society, we can't think of them as single or isolated things, as it were, but both come alive and both are created in the kind of the social interactions between people. So we have a relational approach to the self, which basically argues that the self, we can see the self as a relationship. So we're not seeing the self as an atomistic individual, but a self that comes into being in relationships with other people, but also in relation to other people. And as you'll see in a bit, that's where belonging comes in. And I've listed a few sort of key theorists there who've kind of written about this relational self. And if I've got time towards the end, I've kind of recently thought that actually Cooley's notion of the looking glass self is one that we could sort of metaphorically extend to place, because Cooley's talking about the looking glass self as in relation to people, that we kind of basically other people reflect ourselves back to us, and that is part of our self-perception, is how other people see us. But I think we could kind of metaphorically at least extend this to place. And then the other side of the coin is taking a relational approach to the study of society. And there are kind of various traditions that I've been kind of drawing from. One of them is sort of the ethno-methodological take on social reality or society, not as something that exists in and of itself, but it's something that it has to constantly be reproduced, again, in the interactions between people. So we see kind of social reality as something that's in the making rather than something that just exists. And so social structures then, if we take this point of view, social structures can be viewed as basically fixing in time and space of kind of former social relations, as it were. So once social relations become repetitive, as in become repeated by a huge number of people, these then become what we see as social structures, and they then kind of gain almost a life of their own, or a logic of their own, as it were, after that. And that's why they then kind of appear as though they are these thing-like structures, but we have to keep in mind that they're not things that exist out there. And when I look at belonging, I kind of want to always highlight that by saying that I'm taking a relational view, I'm not just talking about people. So I'm not just talking about relationships to people, but I'm also talking about relationships to kind of more abstract groups or collectives, so imagine communities, if it were, or sort of notions of culture, so connection to culture. But also then material surroundings, I find those are hugely important in terms of our sense of self. But also looking at how social change is kind of sort of filtered into our lives through material change, so changing our kind of physical surroundings, places, objects, and so on. And depending on how much time I've got at the end, I'll say a few more words about that. So first of all then, what is belonging? And just to give a sort of a very short sort of definition here that should be enough for you to follow the rest of the paper, is that it's a sense of ease. So a sense of belonging is basically a sense of ease, both with oneself but also one's surrounding world. And again, remember that surrounding world consists of people, abstract cultures and notions and things, and also places, so the kind of the physical space in which we live. And no surprise that belonging fits very well with a relational approach to self and society, because belonging is inherently relational. It is basically a self in connection. When we're talking about a sense of belonging, we're talking about connectedness, about connection with the surrounding world, or lack of as well. So actually, whenever I say belonging, in your mind, I'm hoping that you'll add not belonging to that, but I'm just saving time by talking about belonging. But belonging always comes with not belonging. So we should never forget that. And I'll say a few words about that in relation to sort of exclusion as a part of belonging. And there have been kind of various theorists some of them indirectly, some of them directly argued that human beings have a basic need to belong. Now, of course, this is one thing that we can never answer definitively, but there is some evidence. I mean, given that theorists say that this is such a need, it's interesting that there's very little research actually done on belonging and its correlation with various aspects of well-being or health. But there are a few studies out there, and they kind of seem to indicate that belonging does correlate with a general sense of well-being or sort of better mental and physical health. And again, we can ask whether belonging is a universal phenomenon or not. Craig Calhoun argues that it is, because he says it's impossible for human beings not to belong to social groups, relations, or culture. And he's talking here on a kind of a conceptual level, a fundamental level. So even a person who would decide to sort of live in a cave as a hermit is still, because of the self as a relational being that has emerged in relationships, that self is always inherently relational, inherently belonging or not belonging to something. And here it is, inclusion and exclusion. So when we're talking about belonging, for a lot of people it comes across as a very fluffy notion. It's like a very, you know, feel-good thing, you know, we belong, that's a good thing, isn't it? But I want to actually take a critical approach. I probably won't have time to say much about that here, but that sometimes actually belonging isn't a very comfortable experience. And also that not belonging isn't necessarily always a negative thing. But part of belonging is that belonging is constructed in terms of who's included and who's excluded. So there's always when belonging is being constructed, another is also being constructed through that. So boundaries are always being drawn between what people belong to, they don't belong to, but also then who belongs and who doesn't belong. And there's lots of theorists who've done work around these kind of us and them distinctions. And I think it's this part that actually is of particular interest for today's workshop. So I'll say a few more words about that in relation to kind of the politics of belonging in a bit. But then very quickly, just a few words about why we would like to sort of, or why I like to use belonging as a concept to kind of explore this connection between self and society. Well, first of all, as I've sort of explained, belonging is a fundamental aspect of the self, if we take a relational approach to the self. And this sense of belonging or not belonging is one of the ways in which our relationship to the world, to the surrounding world, manifests itself. And I'm not saying it's the only way, but it's one of the key ways in which we can actually study the connection between people and their surrounding world. I'm here kind of influenced by my colleague Carol Smart and her work on personal life. And she argues that it's important to take a person-centred view when we're looking at this relationship between self and society. And I think Margaret Archer's talk earlier today was what I took from it, was the emphasis that we have to be looking at also people's, so the kind of the level at which people, as it were, kind of adapt or use the existing social strategies or whatever we want to call them. And also, belonging it's a multidimensional thing. We don't just belong to one thing, but there are many dimensions, there are many sources of belonging, which allows us to kind of look at social change also in a very multidimensional way and look at it as a very complex thing. So there might be sort of change on the cultural level, but not necessarily on the relational and vice versa. So I've kind of identified three, I call them sort of sources of belonging. So first of all, cultural, relational, which means other people, but then also material, so the kind of material and physical world around us. But as I've indicated, there is a politics of belonging. So belonging is, I'll just put those all up there. So belonging is, it isn't just an individual feeling. Although we experience belonging as an individual feeling, as in I belong here or I belong to this group of people. But of course, as sociologists, we're interested in looking at, well, how can we explain this from a more perhaps social perspective, as in how can we explain who belongs where or who belongs with whom? So Nira Yuval Davis, for example, has made this distinction between belonging as an individual feeling, but then also the politics of belonging, which is where the collective aspect comes in, that there's always a politics of belonging involved in terms of groups defining what the parameters of belonging are and who's allowed and who's not allowed to belong. So this is where we start looking at sort of power relations and who has the power to define belonging. And you could, for example, use sort of Bourdieusian terms to look at how this sense of belonging is, to an extent, social and structured. So his concepts of habitus feel and feel for the game are to an extent, they're to an extent useful, but as another colleague of mine, Wendy Bottereau, has pointed out, the concept of habitus kind of leaves out the intersubjectiveness of people's lives. The fact that these habits are actually negotiated in interactions with other people. So habitus is a negotiated accomplishment. And again, I would say that if we're looking at belonging, we can get at this interactiveness a lot easier. So John Schotter has argued that in order to have a sense of belonging, people need to be able to take part in the reflexive arguments of their group or their society. So these are kind of the fundamental arguments about what we should argue about and what's important and why is it important. So this politics of belonging, we can see as when people make a claim for belonging, we can see as a claim, making a claim for space or for recognition, if we look at it on the collective level particularly. So we'll find different groups in society making claims for belonging within that society. And we've got lots of examples. You know, the debates around multiculturalism, for example, in Britain at the moment are kind of an example of this. And here's a theorist who I've only recently sort of started reading, but I very much like the way Axel Honneth sort of formulates this, that having this mutual recognition, so being able to, if we were to use Schotter's words, being able to take part in the reflexive arguments of our society, having this mutual recognition of having our claim for belonging recognised by other people, he argues that this is a precondition for us to be able to exercise the capacities of personhood. And he links, for example, self-esteem and self-confidence and so on to this notion of personhood. And he also talks that there's a moral grammar in these conflicts over recognition, that they're not just about people, sort of individual, atomistic individuals, fighting their corner to get the best thing for themselves, but we must always look at the kind of the moral issues that are involved in these conflicts. And I think we could very well adapt this to the current Greek crisis. And he also says it's important to have a kind of a legally institutionalized recognition of these kind of equals and social relations of recognition. So Yuval Davis then sort of says that if we weren't able to call these conflicts over recognition, then these kind of conflicts over claims for belonging, she says that we must then look at the exercise of power that's involved. And the kind of the political projects of belonging. And again, we can look at nation states and their political projects of belonging in terms of who is allowed citizenship, for example, or what rights come with that citizenship. And whilst we're looking at sort of power relations, we're then looking at how boundaries are being drawn and by whom they're being drawn. And then also the kind of the challenge that goes with that. So as a boundary is being drawn, it's very likely that another group will challenge or contest that boundary. And we can also see, empirically we can see that there are hierarchies of belonging. So I think Professor Mozelis's paper was talking of a hierarchy of belonging within Europe. You could kind of think of it in those terms as well. And we shouldn't forget that there's an affective dimension to this, not surprisingly, given that it is a feeling of belonging on an individual level. So when boundaries are being drawn, we often get sort of these boundaries can be disrespectful, they can be expressed in terms of disgust or contempt. So Tyler's work, for example, on how chavs in this country are vilified by the media, example of the kind of the sort of contempt through which the chav is defined in media, in middle class media. And that very often then alongside this we get the kind of the suffering of the groups who are kind of vilified, and then the notion that this suffering, as I'll get onto in a minute, that this suffering can actually then lead to political change. But it's also important to sort of always keep in mind that history isn't made just on the structural level, that it is made on the individual level. So we have to be looking at both the role of kind of the bigger structures of nation states, for example, but then also individuals in this process. And Yuval Davis has also argued that belonging, it tends to become politicised when it's under threat. And we can kind of look at, for example, the situation in Greece and see to what extent this might be true in Greece at the moment. And she talks about what's happening on a kind of on a global level, and this is something that Nikos Mouzelis's paper was addressing as well. So the kind of the shifts to this kind of neoliberal global economy and the impact that this is having on people's sense of citizenship. And she argues that with the kind of the weakening of the legislative powers or the legislative branches of both national and regional states and organisations means that we now have the executive branch, for example, communicating with transnational corporations or the World Bank. But of course, people have, or citizens have, very little impact then on these negotiations. And so we then get a situation where the global financial market, as we heard earlier today, is actually the governing or the kind of the force, the more forceful in terms of impacting social change. And this then leads to people feeling as though their entitlements as citizens come under threat. And Axel Honneth says that, well, if people have a sense that they deserve something, so in this case that they deserve to have an impact, for example, on the global economy, or how that then leads to how their everyday lives are structured. If this sense is collective, that people are denied what they deserve, this then can lead to collective action. I've only got 5 minutes, I think.
Ten.
Yep. Wow. Excellent. So I won't have to whiz through this, but I'll do a shortened version probably. This is my tenuous link to the Greek crisis there, the photo there. But you could put any photo in that round bubble, and you could talk about belonging within that context. So when I've done a paper on kind of different topics, I can have a photo there of me having dinner with my family and friends, for example. And in any situation, we get these three different sources or modes of belonging in operation, which is why it's important to look at all of them together. So we get the relational aspect of belonging, which is sort of our relationship with people. And not just friends and family, but also strangers and acquaintances are very important in this. And I'll just direct you to the work of David Morgan and his book on acquaintances, but also the work of Lynn Laughland, looking at urban forms of association between strangers and acquaintances here. So the kind of relations we have with strangers and acquaintances can be very important, because they can actually, for example, from our perspective, determine the sort of the feel of a place, or whether or not we feel that we belong somewhere. Then there's the cultural or the symbolic aspect of belonging, and this is the one that's received most attention from researchers so far. So we can look at belonging in terms of sort of cultural tools such as language, practices or traditions. Food, clothing are part of these kind of cultural traditions. That can sort of be part of a person's sense of belonging. But then perhaps more importantly, abstract groupings, or what Benedict Anderson has called imagined communities, for example, well, in his case, nationhood. But we could have other imagined communities, for example, ethnicity or social class. And then the third aspect is the material or the embodied aspect of belonging. And here it's both belonging in terms of within our own bodies, but also how our body belongs, feels as though it belongs in the world. So we're looking at space or place and material objects. I'll say a few words about each of these. I think I'll skip the relational belonging one, because I think that's fairly straightforward. But there's maybe just to point out that Danny Miller has perhaps controversially argued that this belonging to people is perhaps more important than identity or citizenship. And he says that people tend to care rather more about the people they love than the definition of who exactly they are. I don't know if everyone would agree to this, particularly if it's a question of oppressed people who don't get to define who exactly they are. But then just a few words about cultural belongings. So I've kind of mentioned we can look at this from very many different perspectives. So we can look at culture or cultural practices, we can look at belonging to social categories. For example, I've explored people's sense of belonging to the social category of lone mother. Other concepts that have been used in relation to this is that of ideal types or imagined communities. And we get complex mixtures of belonging and unbelonging within each of these, as many people, including Christensen, have argued. And the important thing here is that these cultures, they're always bounded. So again, there's always this boundary being drawn between us and them. Our culture, we do things a particular way here. They do things differently. And I think we can see this happening, for example, in the debates within the kind of the Eurozone at the moment. It's very much a kind of us and pitting against us and them. And of course, this kind of this notion of the way we are, or this kind of dominant narrative of who we are as a nation or a social class or a gender even, it's a result of remembering and forgetting, where of course powerful groups play an important role, because they perhaps get more say in terms of defining, for example, a history of a nation or a group of people. So in relation to the cultural identities, it's very important to explore who is included or excluded, for example, from this notion of European identity at the moment. And this is then linked to notions of the relational self. Because as part of the relational self, in order to be able to claim belonging in their group or their society, they have to be able to sort of perform a morally acceptable self. And this ability to communicate that one is an acceptable self in order to be accepted, in order to be recognised by other people in our group, that then involves all of the above. And who is able to communicate an acceptable self, for example, is not a simple, straightforward matter. And again, I could take the example of lone mothers here, that for some lone mothers it can actually be quite difficult to perform an acceptable motherhood, for example, on the basis of their family structure. And then lastly, but not leastly, at least for me, come these embodied belongings, because every form of belonging entails some form, well, embodiment, because we experience in and through our bodies, but often also forms of physical closeness. So we have physical touch in relationships. We actually we touch the objects in our lives. We sing national anthems. We wear clothes, and so on. And here's a quote from two more of my colleagues, Jennifer Mason and Catherine Davis, talking about the sensory as being tangled with the social, the cultural, and the political. So we can't really separate the sensory or the embodied from these. And they kind of point to the fact that the sensory is likely to be class, gendered, and so on. But also we need to understand the ways in which class, gender, and these other social categories are themselves also sensory. I won't spend a lot of time on this, just to say that we can actually kind of make the argument that these sensory forms of belonging are very important in constituting our sense of self, and through that then constituting society. And there's kind of three aspects to this. There's first our connection to the world, so our kind of the way in which we perceive the world and the way that in which we move through the world, for example. And of course these are then shaped sort of socioculturally, as Mason and Davis noted in the earlier quote. But then there's this notion of ourselves being tied to particular places. So we become people from particular places. And then that place is seen to reflect our personality, both on an individual and a collective level. But then also, and using Danny Miller's argument here, that material objects also constitute our sense of self. And if you're interested in reading more about that, you can read his book called Stuff, because I won't have time to explain what he means by that now, because I want to conclude. So to conclude, basically I've made three points here today. First, that belonging is a good concept to use if we're wanting to study the connection between self and society, and particularly the impact of social change on the self. Belonging is a very good window through which we can do this. Second, that belonging, there's always power relations are always involved in these claims for belonging, and that it's not just a case of an individual feeling, but it has a collective element to it as well. But also then that belongings are very complex, and this is why I've argued that belonging is a way of looking at social change, because as we know, social change is complex as well and happens at very many different levels. And I've only touched at some of the levels at which it goes on here. And I'll end there.
Thank you. Excellent time management. Very interesting presentation. So let's move to Matt's presentation, and then we will try to allow like 20 minutes for questions. So, is that yours? So if I may just say that Matt is going to talk about the being as nothingness, reflexivity, and the new sociologies of class, it rings a bell of being a nothingness. You know, it's a very
like a word by a word play.
Exactly. Absolutely. So please.
Yes, I suppose I should admit to start with that I'm a bit rusty on reflexivity. It's something I've tried to get away from in the last couple of years. There's only so many much you can. I don't know, reflecting on reflexivity constantly starts to do your head in after a while, or it does mine, but I seem to be getting dragged back to it anyway, in some sense or another, so maybe I have to accept it's part of my soul. So, back in 2007, I wrote a book, Self and Social Change, and that was an attempt to select some of the kind of grand theorisations of the interrelationship between the interpenetration of self and social change, theories of self and social change. And because at that time the most familiar theory to me, and the one that appealed at least as a critical foil, was Giddens and Beck's theory of reflexivity and individualisation. So I used that as my basis, and thought about reflexivity through different theoretical approaches. So, again, what seemed like dominant tropes at the time. So, psychoanalytic approaches to reflexivity in terms of narcissism, understanding reflexivity as a form of narcissism. Foucault's understanding of reflexivity kind of as a form of self, maybe imposed self-regulation, and so on and so forth. And since then, at least up until I moved away from reflexivity, I guess that I've been interested in two related prevailing sociological observations. And that's been a critical interest. I'm not saying I agree with them. But the first is that the self is necessarily and incessantly engaged in its own reflexive production. So that follows from Giddens et al. Theory since the early 90s. As Margaret said, it's an extended reflexivity rather than this kind of routine reflexivity that Giddens acknowledges all people of all time practice, and a form of extended reflexivity that supposedly marks late modernity. And the second one is that increasingly consumption emerges, at least in those cosmopolitan western northern sites, emerges as the privileged site for this identity work. So, yeah, I guess until recently that's kind of captured more or less what I've been interested in. I've worked a lot with Jane Roseborough in looking at the relationship between these sociological observations. I've been interested as a psychologist. Well, I say I'm a psychologist, I'm not sure if I'm a psychologist or not really. I think sometimes I'm just pretending, but I've got away with it so far anyway. So, yeah, in Giddens' own work, you can see this, mid-90s, you know, he talks about reflexivity sometimes, not always, in terms of consumption practices. In relation to his theory of the local-global dialectic, he says the local and the global is connected. You have to remember that Giddens was coming out wanting to theorise an alternative to a pessimistic psychosocial fragmentation thesis. He says, actually, there is a lot of loss, but reflexivity also allows for a dialectic between the local and the global. And one of his vehicles for that was consumerism. As you can see from that quote, you know, that even the purchase of individual items for the consumer indicates, reflects, maintains, furthers an extraordinary connectedness, increasing connectedness between actors in the social world. And it indicates new forms of autonomy and connectedness for Giddens. And he was quite pressing it in some ways. You know, he kind of preempted, although ethical consumption has been around for generations of some form or another, today's rise in explicit ethical and political consumerist movements are to some extent based on this combination of a form of reflexivity and a form of consumption. Think about something like fair trade. That's on a reflexive consideration of the production process, the relationships between production and consumption, or if you like, the relationship between producer and consumer, so connectedness. It's trying to encourage a reflexivity, a transparency in relation to the production process. So reflexivity combines with shopping. But what I've been particularly interested in is a critique of this idea of extended reflexivity. Since way back, it's always struck me as an odd idea that, or at least maybe a seductive idea, but not necessarily correct, that we today are the most reflexive people that have ever been, and it's those people in the past that aren't quite as reflexive as us, or those people outside of our particular culture that aren't quite as reflexive as us. And following that instinct up, I found lots of other people who have argued that something along the lines of this statement, that reflexivity, whatever we might like to think of it as, is always embedded within particular normative discursive frames of choice. So it's bound up in these, I like this phrase I came across recently, canonical cultural narratives. Reflexivity is driven, bound up in particular narratives rather than transcending them or stepping outside of them somehow. So as again Margaret said, there are lots of different versions of reflexivity in different places, and what marks out different reflexivities in a way, what I've been interested in, is the way that they reflect dominant cultural narratives, perhaps. And one of the canonical, if not the canonical cultural narratives sociologists often argue today is consumerism, commodification. So someone like Bauman lays that on a bit thick, but he's always going on about, isn't he, how consumerism has become the default way in which we can make sense of our lives. And he cites Campbell there, which is a nice quote on how pervasive a consumerist and commodified subjectivity has become. A philosophy, it says there, but Bauman also talked about it in terms of subjectivity. And again, I'm attracted to this kind of logic. For me, Mead, social psychology, but also Vygotsky, this idea that our subjective, our reflexivity, our turning back upon ourselves, the way we do that through, right from very early on in our life, through the cultural narratives that we adapt through other people. And someone like Mead, social psychology, for me, is helpful for thinking about how reflexivity is bound into particular cultural narratives. But what's also interesting for me is how, the next step from there, is that it's arguable that the way reflexivity is embedded in particular normative discursive framings, particularly consumerism, can actually help perpetuate forms of social inequality. And that's why I put new class analysis or something like that in the title, because that's when I became drawn to new class, new sociologies of class, I suppose. And I guess in these class analyses there's a further disruption of this relationship between reflexivity and consumption and autonomy and empowerment somehow. So who am I thinking about here? I've written down some examples, got people like Valerie Hay, Stephanie Lawler, Angela McRobbie, Andrew Sayer, Bev Skeggs, Mike Savage. Their kind of work, I think, has been called, not just by me, but by others, as new sociologies of class, returning to issues of class after people like Beck and Giddens have said that they've become zombie categories, saying actually, no, they're still very important, but they're inscribed in different, maybe novel contemporary ways. And lots of this new sociology of class has gone back to Bourdieu, not just Bourdieu's notion of distinction, also his notion of habitus field, but particularly his notion of distinction. And it's a way, I suppose, of bringing a critique of these prevailing observations around reflexivity in consumer society together. So in this kind of work, middle-class authorities confer taste as a process of distinction is seen as vital. Consumption and identity are key to being able to confer taste on certain products, certain ways of life, certain ways of doing things. But not everyone has that authority. The middle and the upper classes do, and they have the ability to decide what is tasteful or tasteless. But it's recast as an individual choice, a reflexive choice, what your tastes are, what your tastes are not. But actually it reflects and maintains a particular social order. So the middle class tend to express distaste or disgust at particularly working class lifestyles and contemporary social relations. And Lawless argued this is a kind of psychic requirement because of the proximity these days of classes. Not necessarily economic or material proximity, maybe even a social and symbolic proximity. As the older distinctions between class collapse, there's a kind of psychic requirement to maintain existence at some level, and new sociologists class argue this is done effectively through emotions like disgust, particularly in terms of consumption practices. That's how we do taste. But at the same time, it's argued, there's an increased polarisation in recent years. Social change, this is a key social change for me, one of the most important, a growing polarity. So as well as using a critique of consumption practices and reflexivity practice to talk about middle class taste and how the middle class work is doing this, there's also an emphasis on those on the margins, the poorer, the experience of those not clearly the beneficiaries of social change, or maybe those today increasingly on a trajectory of downward mobility. Those excluded from the right kinds of consumption and maybe even the right kinds of reflexivity. And we're all probably familiar now with many empirical studies and so on that point to increasing polarisation in terms of material inequalities. So distribution of wealth, the bottom line, and associated life chances. Key aspects of social change, particularly between skilled and unskilled work. Things like poor health, bad housing, limited employment, fewer rights of movement, even toxic waste, to quote to cite Bauman, always run downhill on the path, economic path of least resistance. And actually, what these new analysts also argue is an inability to escape from these increasing polarised fields. It's only a problem if you're in the marginalised field, of course, the worst one off. An inability to escape from those fields. Maybe the most accurate definition of class today. So So a radical lack of mobility between these fields, or a stratification more generally. So a kind of entrenchment where there's no escape from class positions. And there are accounts too, aren't there, of an equally kind of bounded and separate gated communities for the richest in our society as well. Defenders' spaces. To the point where Ehrenreich says, some odd optical property of our highly polarised society makes the poor almost invisible to their economic superiors, even where in places like Cancun, Mexico, where they're living in very close proximity. So, the argument from there would be that although there might be this increasing polarity, any kind of reflexivity that may be engendered as part of social change in relation to that, to social change, is actually highly problematic for those experiencing it. So if there is an extended reflexivity thesis, even though elsewhere whether we can talk about an extended reflexivity, if there is some kind of extended reflexivity in relation to the social changes in which we're going through, it's problematic. So empirical studies have suggested that it's often via reflexive capabilities, so via the ability to see through some aspects of the situations in which people find themselves, that we perceive the lack of opportunities that we have, the dearth of opportunities that we have for mobility. And this is a very particular effective dimension, new sociologists have asked, to realise, to use reflexivity, to realise that you are in a situation of unadorned exclusion, has a very effective impact for new sociologists of class. That sense of invisibility, of nothing, of being the receiving end of disgust. So in this sense, reflexive capabilities, as much as we can talk about them, accentuate the experience of polarity and exclusion. What they do is add to or paint in brighter colours this picture of unadorned exclusion. I'm always wary of harking back to any kind of golden age of working class identity, but Bottereau talks about something like an unravelling of the connection between class location and class identity, which does maybe sound a little bit nostalgic, but there was at least, whatever we thought about working class existence, a sense of cultural location and identity that we got from that. But in an age that's come increasingly through social change, maybe reflexive, that sense of location unravels. So we get something like Camus' quote there, which I think is an extension that applies to everyone, but you could argue that applies increasingly to those who are in fields of unadorned exclusion, maybe. And to tie that back into consumerism, we could, in terms of what Bauman's talked about as the collateral victims of consumerism, perhaps, maybe an increasingly growing number with downward mobility. So people lack the resources to consume properly in consumer society, those on the margins. And reflexivity of that awareness, which you could say is increased through technologies, social media and so on. We are increasingly aware of what's available in consumer society, even if we don't have the ability to choose these things. So reflexivity in this context doesn't bring any more choice. So the connection between autonomy somehow and reflexivity that Giddens conjures up is broken. So what it actually encourages a painful awareness of a lack of choice in these kind of contexts, extended reflexivity. And if reflexivity really is bound into these canonical cultural narratives around consumption and consumerism that navigate our identities for us, if they do, then reflexivity in relation to these consumer narratives, for those who have not and have no choice, might further consolidate this sense of muteness, powerlessness, rather than alleviating. So thinking about this and trying to really struggle to think about what on earth I have to say to anything about what's really going on in social reality, which is a very interesting thing for a sociologist or a psychologist to try and do. You think, yeah, I'm a theorist of self and social change, and then someone asks you to come and talk about some actual experiences that are going on in the world, and you realise how abstract some of these things sound. So I tried to make the connection. I thought, when I was thinking again about Bauman here in terms of, right, is reflexivity played out in relation to consumer society somehow? Is this really happening? And are those who are really on the receiving end of the real bad stuff that's going on now, are they experiencing themselves and narrating their experiences in relation to some kind of reflexivity that comes up against, problematically comes up against these consumer narratives? And that's Bauman's term, that the riots in London, and you could say to some extent the riots in Paris, which you're in whenever they were, 2005, was it? Maybe a bit later. He says that they're evidence of consumerism coming home to roost. I think there's some, for me, there's some validation of my arguments, maybe I'm just looking for it here, or the argument I've made so far anyway. In, I think this is a lot of work by the University of Manchester, actually, that have been funded to do some work around the kind of background narratives to people involved in the riots. Is that right? So here's just a couple of examples. So this is from one researcher's, the one on your left in The Guardian, and I'll draw your attention to the bit where it says, instead, he claims, all they have left, so dismembered fields of existence where, you know, a location, a cultural identity of working class has gone, all they have left is the pursuit of consumerist thrills that provide momentary pleasure. But they're also reflexively aware that they can't have these pleasures, necessarily. This disaffection is amplified when considered in light of regeneration that has become synonymous with post-1990s Manchester. So these kind of meccas of consumerism that people are increasingly excluded from, but aware of, reflexively, the choices that others have. And this is being here used as an explanation for why people riot, or why they rioted in Manchester anyway. So it is located firmly in relation to consumerist narratives. And this one on the right, I thought so earlier anyway, even more so suggested it, if I can find the right bit again. Yeah, so, yeah, as consumers first and foremost, I mean, this might be putting the words into the writer's mouth to some extent, but first and foremost, the inability to shop made them feel unfulfilled and lacking in self-respect. I mean, there it is in black and white, isn't it? You know, that reflexivity, awareness of a lack through these canonical consumer narratives creates a strong sense of disaffection, of effective dynamics, to the point where people are willing to riot. So, I kind of, maybe almost for a second or two, felt a bit smug there, but I managed to stumble across something that seemed to offer some support for the argument I was sketchily building up. But then I kind of tried to think about this, and I've always got a problem with Bauman anyway. I think he's got this kind of grumpy air about the way he writes that can be seductive, but also can be annoying sometimes. And this quote gets at it for me, I think, what I find difficult to take about Bauman's analysis. And Margaret, you picked up on something similar in Bauman earlier. For defective consumers, these contemporary have-nots, non-shopping is a jarring and festering stigma of a life unfulfilled and of their own nonentity and good for nothings. I mean, Bauman's here is kind of being a little bit ironic. He's saying this is how people are positioned, and the dominant cultural canonical narratives position people in this way, and they end up reflexively feeling these kinds of states and, you know, the society gives them it to them. So I'm asking, when I read this quote, is that really it then? Does that capture me enough, what's going on in social reality with the kind of crises that we're going through? Bauman also says somewhere that we're going through this alone. Another quick quote. Each flawed consumer licks his or her wounds in solitude, at best in the company of their as yet unbroken family. But other people have said it in more kind of subtle ways, like Valerie Hay talks about marginalised experience these days being about a dissipated sociality. So they're kind of thinking about these responses as being in isolation. But this is where I think we have to admit, or I have to admit, no one else has to admit it at all, I have to admit it, that as an academic trying to theorise about the relationship between social change and selfhood, that we're always playing catch-up, and that's why I like this quote, because it kind of acknowledges that explicitly, and it captures my feeling in trying to do something like this. So I'll just try to think about it one more time before I spoke today then. What's the problem here then, that it's not quite getting at? what I think it is that even in critical work around reflexivity and consumerist narratives, there's a tendency to individualise experience. So even in critical work that's saying what Bex and Giddens et al. Do is individualise people, when they talk about people being located in, actually reflexivity is located in relation to class structures and so on, there's still a tendency to individualise people's experience. And at the same time, I think there's a related, but not exactly the same, tendency to downplay processes of resistance in people's talk. Which, I won't try and pronounce that name, but he calls the type of process, which includes vindicating oneself and one's claims, rediscovering skills, re-establishing social bonds, redefining one's own identity in the face of other people's representations. I think we have to pay attention to these, otherwise there's a danger of, I've got another quote here, danger in engaging in the engaging in the debates about material inequality. There's a danger that one disappears into the lack discourse one is critiquing. And I can see the danger in that when we're critiquing people in terms of not being able to match up to consumerist narratives and their own reflexivity.
Is that it?
Almost.
Okay, sorry.
Sorry, nearly there. Yeah, I did pause there and look at you. Yeah. So, yes. So, and maybe if there is some kind of reflexivity going on in relation to these kinds of social changes, that we have to acknowledge that they're intersubjective as well. So, which made me think of, I've never thought about Margaret's term before, which is probably a better one, forms of communicative reflexivity might be important to pay attention to. Yes, that was it. So I'll end there, thank you.
Thank you very much. Great, fantastic. So we do have plenty of time for questions. And may I just say that up until now, a variety of different views have been discussed regarding reflexivity, but on social change as well, which hopefully gives food for thought. So shall we begin with questions, please? Yes, please.
I'm just interested, you talk about the consumer narrative, and obviously it's quite important, but at the same time, you know, to be a consumer, you know, you also have to be a producer, or locked in social network or whatever. And, you know, a lot of the stuff you can say is in the consumer narrative, but is there not a parallel producer narrative within the individual that says I am both producer and consumer? Maybe, you know, you talk about defective consumers, but also defective producers at the same time, the two are sort of linked, but I don't know, it seems to be linked.
Yeah.
And, you know, some sort of theory of esteem, but again, the narrative, prevailing narrative, seems based on consumption rather than production, rather than the defective, say, defective consumer.
Yeah, well, actually, I agree. I didn't mean to suggest that I thought that consumer narrative was the only. So I would say, in my understanding of it, actually, people's realities are much more complex, and I don't think people buy into consumerist narratives as much as people like Bauman would have us believe. It's a kind of handy shorthand for a social critique of an ideological critique of problematic narratives that do circulate and that do create problems. But I think that people buy into all sorts of, not buying to, it's not the right word, commodified discourse there, isn't it? People engage with all sorts of narratives around belonging, for instance, and often, in fact, I would agree with someone like Daniel Miller that consumption narratives are actually a way of doing things like belonging and exchange and gift-giving and so on. They suggest something more complex. So I agree that there's much more to it, but maybe there is something in the fact that in societies like Britain, at least for the middle classes, maybe, so we, you know, we're narrowing it down now, production identity has waned and consumption identity has been on the ascendancy. So who we are as producers in a service economy is maybe less important to people's identity than the things they have around them and the things they do in their leisure time. But, you know, I'm not certain about that either. But, you know, maybe there's been a shift in the way that people identify themselves in relation to consumption, as opposed to what they produce. But you're not sure?
Well, I mean, the question, I mean, what I think is that there seems to be, from your presentation, there is a dominant consumer narrative, but equally there doesn't seem to be a producer narrative. And of course, the consumption is about things, because that's the outward, manifestation of a healthy lifestyle, according to that narrative,
mm-hmm.
or the system that supports it.
Yeah.
But actually, in a service space, it's like consume both services and we produce services.
I think a consumer narrative can be about consuming services as well.
But in terms of production, you said that things, stuff, intangible stuff, is also a lot of people are involved in services. Somehow the focus seems to be more like the things. I don't know, that's the impression.
Mm.
Well, talking about consumerism and reflexivity, I couldn't help but wonder, you have used two examples of how people who do not have the choice of consuming that much anymore, how dissatisfied they feel. And I was thinking about the examples from Greece. So I talked with some people, and without asking them directly what do they feel about extensive consumption, they chose to talk about the topic, and they said that, well, extensive consumerism was a problem in Greece, because we thought that we could have it all. Now we realize that we can't. And actually, when we didn't need them. We didn't need what we consumed. But now we realize that we can live with less. This, of course, might be a way of, justifying the fact that they cannot afford buying more. This I understand. But at the same time, I think a different kind of reflexivity involved here, actually saying, well, yeah, we don't have enough. We do not use our reflexivity to get more, but we use our reflexivity to actually understand what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm interested in now, actually, is environmental crisis and narratives that are produced around that. But there's an interesting conflict, isn't there, between economic crisis and environmental crisis
right.
in relation to consumption. But, no, I would agree. So, something like communicative or intersubjective reflexivity
right.
has potential of questioning. Well, it doesn't have the potential, does it? It's already going on. So, transition towns, eco-villages, all sorts of movements around the world, I would say,
right.
are examples of communal or communicative reflexivity that are challenging consumer narratives. I'm not saying this is not happening or it couldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know enough about the Greek situation to know whether people on the ground are saying, actually, our reflexivity has been bound into consumption, but there are other ways of living and we don't need some of the stuff we need. And I don't know if that's happening or not. So I don't know exactly what the standard of living is like or what people are saying. But
well, maybe they were borrowing money to consume more. That was the idea in Greece, right?
Yeah.
So now they can't borrow anymore and they can't consume anymore.
Yeah.
So they reflect on that. Oh, this is what it seems, that is the impression. They have a response to that. And contrary to the quote that you presented, they are not like, well, we're dissatisfied because we cannot borrow more money so that we cannot spend more.
Mm.
And I just think that this is interesting because it's kind of different of what you were saying. I mean, it is not necessary that reflexivity would work that way. It would work in the actually opposite way.
Yeah, I think the riots, you could, depending on how you select the quotes, you could read as saying this is a consumerist riot, consumerism coming home to roost.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can read them in that way because, superficially, because of the looting, basically.
Right.
But I think the protests that are happening, not just in Greece but elsewhere, you can't read so easily in Bauman's terms as a kind of flawed consumer in a flawed consumer discourse because I think other forms of solidarity there are emerging,
mm-hmm.
reflexive communications and so on that are as yet we don't know. We don't know where they'll go yet.
Any more questions, please? Gentleman in the back, thank you.
You mentioned belonging, consumerism. Just to bring the example of London, in London, when you regenerate and consumer prices go up, you usually turf out the original inhabitants, the council flats. The prices go up, and you do it in a sort of an income cleansing of the area. And people move into other existing areas where there are a little bit more slummy. In Athens, it's the opposite. No air part of Athens has been regenerated. It has been degenerated, and the regeneration takes place where the new construction takes place. So the house rises up, if it's new, it's higher, if it's old, it's lower. It's an interesting sort of dynamic, quite opposite dynamics between London and Athens. But coming back to this, I suppose you know in London, it's better than the Athenian. How does this process affect productivity? How does it affect self-perception? And how does it affect the sense of belonging? Because it does create a lot of tensions between new money, old money, old inhabitants, new inhabitants.
There's been a bit of research on regeneration areas from a belonging perspective. One of them is by Monica Dagan, and she was particularly looking at sensory belongings, because these were regenerated areas in Manchester and Barcelona, where the sensory played a huge part, because these areas were whitewashed, well, kind of pastel washed, so any kind of strong colours were washed out. The new buildings were kind of sandstone colour, but also cleansing of different smells. So in Manchester, cleansing of smells attached to industry. So those industrial workshops were removed from that area. With that, lots of jobs and a particular way of life and particular ways of working were removed. And that did have a profound impact on the people who still live in that area, now in the outskirts of that area, because they can't afford the flats in the regenerated area. So it does have a profound impact on people's sense of belonging, and on many levels. So that there's the sensory, because the whole look and feel of the area is now a very middle class, consumerist oriented look and feel, but also then relational, because new people move in. So there's another regeneration area, for example, in Manchester, where the regenerated area, which is old mills, have been regenerated into flats or sort of refurbished into flats, and then circling it is this old council estate. And that is half of it's boarded up. And the regenerated, for example, the new build flats are very, you know, probably 10 stories more, 20 stories high. And the council estate can kind of look at that. There's like this physical monstrosity hanging over you. But you've got then the new people moving into the area, and in that case, it's not so much an ethnic difference, a class difference in that area, but it's ethnicity. It's the white, it's cleansing in terms of ethnicity as well in some regeneration areas. So it has a profound effect on all these levels of belonging, definitely. Do you want to address the productivity?
Well, I guess it's another example of the materialisation of polarisation, isn't it? It's another version of polarisation, geographical. So one area in particular becomes focused for a particular kind of consumption that's available, particular forms of reflexivity in relation to that, and lifestyle, and others become separated out further and ghettoised and separate again. So it was to support this argument about an increased polarisation being a marker of social change, and the things that come with that, which is still as yet unknown, but might be indignation in terms of not being able to consume, but it might be indignation in terms of a critique of this, the very ideology of consumerism as well.
I had a response actually to the example you had from the people you spoke to in Athens. And I was just aware of the way you phrased the people's responses to being aware, certainly reflexively aware of their own consumption. It seems to me it's more like that they're reflexively aware of their current precarity. And okay, people might be annoyed that they can't particularly buy the newest pair of Ray-Bans, but the way it was phrased, it seemed to me there's a kind of value attached, like, oh, how good we are for suddenly not wanting to buy a new pair of jeans. And whereas, in fact, what it seems to me is that there's now a sense of belonging that has arisen, which is more like a solidarity in the moment of understanding, the reflective moment of understanding, that people have been done to, that there's a sense of common deprivation, perhaps not deprivation of how much extra cash you have in your wallet, but a sense of what has been eroded in a wider sense, in the spatial sense as well, and in a sense of a potential future, that the subject becomes something that we might consider belonging, so just referring back to those two subjects.
I think it's improper for the chair to respond to a comment. Thank you for that. I would be more than happy to discuss about that at the next session that I'm going to discuss extensively about the comment that I have just used, but I don't want to take the time from the presenters, but thank you for that. Another question, please? Yes.
When you talk about the relational aspect of itself, you talked mainly about the self-other relationship. What about the self-self relationship? What happens to this relationship today, or as things are sort of developing? I have a feeling from my experience in Greece that the self-self relationship gets much stronger today as escapes of various forms through consumption, through television, etc. As these are restricted, people turn inside themselves and they reflect about themselves and what they were doing up to now. What's the meaning of life, and so forth. And an indication of this is that particularly young people who are unemployed, highly educated, unemployed, they join meditation groups. An attraction to Oriental religions, Buddhism, Taoism, etc., are very attractive to young people. Not so much the established religions, but rather religions which emphasize experience rather than dogma. It's not a question, what are you going to believe? But really an attempt to open themselves up to the spiritual dimension, which has been disappeared for a long time in post-war societies.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and it sort of made me think about work around biography, so people's life stories, and the idea is that it's particularly around people when people experience turning points in their lives. And I think, like, for example, the Greek crisis could be seen as a national but also an individual turning point. For many people it means unemployment, it means loss of income and so on, so that is a major turning point. And in those times, what happens is that the narrative that people have been telling themselves up until then, and again, we can argue whether or not it's an inherent need or capacity in humans to want to tell these coherent narratives that kind of, where, so that where you are today can actually be explained by your past. So when a turning point happens, the person generally has to then rewrite their life story to an extent in order to make sense of where they are today. So I think that's probably what happens in that, and that does involve, if you really want to do it, that does involve, in a way, those internal conversations with yourself, lengthy ones at times. The spiritualism, I don't profess to know what's going on there, but it's interesting, because it's almost as though spiritualism is the antithesis to capitalism, as though there isn't space for spiritualism within capitalism.
Or not spiritualism, but
or consumerism.
Because spiritualism very often has the connotation of calling sort of dead people to have communication.
Oh, so spirituality, yeah.
Spirituality,
yeah. Spirituality,
rather than spirituality.
Yeah. Apologies, my Finnishness came through there. interesting. I don't know, do you have any points on the spirituality?
Well, only that the kinds of religion you're talking about, or these kind of more esoteric version of them, actually, what they're actually doing in practice is encouraging a very different form of reflexivity. So I strongly believe there are different versions to the dominant forms that we have, which tends to be ratiocination, cognition.
Exactly. Yeah.
Whereas they do encourage a form of reflexivity, what I know about all of them in common, but it's a very different kind. It's a kind of non-linguistic version of reflexivity.
Exactly.
So maybe they're drawn. Maybe people have been drawn to that version of reflexivity, which is very different.
Yes.
So they kind of
the different type of reflexivity that Giddens talks about, which is very cognitive oriented, rationalistic.
Yeah.
You know, you set a goal and then you choose rationally the means to achieve the goal, and then once you achieve that, you go further and further.
Yeah.
Whereas this is the opposite. It is what I have called apophatic reflexivity, that is to say you turn inside, not in order to choose or to see how to achieve a goal, but apophatically, meaning getting away from apophatic reflexivity is a theological term. I mean, the apophatic, not the reflexivity, in the sense that you get away from thinking, from language, from images. You empty yourself. This is the apophatic, rather than cataphatic, which is what Giddens is doing. You get away from language, and then the goal emerges. You don't set the goal. You don't choose. You get away from the tyranny of choices, which is what you are suffering in sort of late modernity. And what you should do emerges. And I think this type of reflexivity is growing. And it's going to grow even if we go beyond the crisis.
I don't know, would you like to respond first, or?
No.
Okay, please, Morgan.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's only one way we will get at this. It was very interesting, the use of the grammatical persons that everybody was using this afternoon in relation to reflexivity, because it was always we, first person plural, impute it to them, to the actors. Now, actors do not reflect in terms of canonical, hegemonic discourses about anything. They reflect in the first person singular. Relationally, of course, because all of our relations in the natural, practical, and social world are quintessentially relational. I don't know why you apologize for being a relational sociologist, there's no other kind. But the first person got lost in a lot of this discussion, how people themselves find the quandaries, dilemmas, exigencies, emergencies that they're in. And there's certainly no immaculate perception on the part of the first person singular subject. But having said that, doesn't mean ordinary folks can't tell us something about what hurts them most about the situation they find themselves in. I mean, you're quoting Andrew Sayer. Good, I like this book very much too, Morality Matters. The human capacity for incineration and for suffering are in relation to a human person's reaction to something of that kind. And we need to know how they phrase it, not what words the sociologist will put in their mouth about them being defective consumers or, you know, just games players. Because it's how they see it which affects, not their analysis. Not going to them for the analysis. It affects what they do. And therefore, to understand what they do, we've got to understand how they themselves see it, including this crucially important big caveat. They don't do it all in words. At all.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Would you like to respond to that, or?
No, only that I agree, yeah, that's the way we have to elaborate it. So people like Charles with Phenomenology of the Working Classes, where the best analysis for me are where he's allowing people to speak themselves and actually allowing them to speak themselves in the phenomenological framework as a way of allowing people to speak themselves rather than analysis. Yeah, I agree. But then the problem is, of course, in a situation like this, what it comes down to is my interpretation or someone else's interpretation of what they said. Still, we still come back to that in situations like this, but I agree.
Yeah, but it doesn't even get a look in if we start off with, you know, Locke's theory of... I mean, even the consumptionist is interesting. There's a study done in Nevada about grocery shopping.
About?
Grocery shopping. I mean, perhaps the most boring form of necessary shopping going. And it was amazing when people were talking about why they put what they did from the market into their shopping baskets. It was explicitly relational. I'm buying this because an elaborate amount of thought, not cost-benefit analysis, I mean, nothing could be further from rational choice theory, a lot of thought about what different members of the family who probably will be there for dinner that night, the next night, the following night, would like, would need, couldn't eat, and then, you know, elaborate maternal trade-offs, which, you know, not about the position of motherhood or the vision of mother, but just very down to earth things about, you know, one kid's been beaten up this week, had a rough week at school, how can I jig things? I mean, what can you have as more practical relational thinking? How can I jig things so that the family eats well, but I can put something special on his plate, by his table, in his bed, to give him a bit of a lift from the interpersonal batterings he's had from his mates? Consumption, shopping, isn't necessarily consumerism, essential for day-to-day survival, but done relationally, done reflexively, not just about what can I have, but what are my fundamental concerns? That's what I think all reflexivity is about, one's concerns. If your kids come very close to the list, they'll play a big role in it. If your career comes very close to the list, that will play a huge role in it. Mm. We will get regularities, scrap our correlation coefficients. But on that first person, who I am is what I care about, to quote Harry Frankfurt, there's a lot more leverage on why people do exactly what they do do in the marketplace. And themselves another shop.
Let's take one last question before we'll take some time to have coffee. Yes, please.
I'd just like to explore the kind of relationship with outside influences such as sort of government, but also the kind of social media. You know, we had a little bit of sort of thought on people are structuring themselves, saying, well, actually, I choose fair trade, because that's what I believe in. And I mean, even it wasn't the government that actually kind of closed the News of the World, it was actually kind of people's sort of attitude and that kind of social change. So that sense of longing, you know, people would like to explore that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think that connects with the point that social change doesn't just happen out there. It happens in people's everyday lives, and this kind of connects to Margaret's point as well. It's in people's everyday lives where they make these negotiations, and that's where, I mean, we can talk of the politics of belonging that happens at a national level, but the impact it has on people's everyday lives. For example, the like a nation's choice of who gets citizenship or how they get citizenship, who gets a passport. And so on, and the impact that these have on people's lives, for example, the citizenship test in this country. So I think they're kind of hugely hugely important that to see that connection, but also to then understand that social change, because if we take the relational approach to society and social structures are not something that sort of exists over and above us, then that means that it's through action that they change. But often that's slow, but then in periods like today, we can see that it's quite fast, it can happen very fast as well. And I think it's when it happens very fast is when it can have a sort of, I wouldn't say more profound impact on people's sense of belonging, but the it can be more jarring, as it were.
Yeah, I think it's easy to overlook how amazing some kind of achievements like fair trade are, even though in my academic position we're often criticising it for being a form of colonialism still, and so on and so forth. Fair trade is one of the only things this year that's bucked the trend, actually. Things like organic shopping are down, but fair trade carries on rising in the West, the North European, so it's still being bought. But yeah, I think in some ways it kind of supports a theory like Giddens's that says local global dialectic, extended connection, increasing transparency, reflexivity, people getting together but in individualistic ways, maybe through consumption, to make significant changes to people's lives a very long, long way away. I mean, that's an amazing achievement in a sense, but then once you start to think through it, I always end up in an ambivalent position, because then in the detail the money doesn't always get to the people who really need it. It's still bound by maybe patriarchal rules in the local communities sometimes, let's say, or you're actually reinforcing a north-south luxury goods divide, and so all these things end up being complicated again. Yet I agree that the impetus for change that comes by individuals getting together in these ways is throwing up some amazing changes.
Do you feel, though, that social media platforms have actually changed that dynamic?
For me, it's too soon to say. I could say something glib like, just yes, definitely, but I don't really know. I don't know whether they're latching on to something that's occurring anyway and speeding it up, or whether they're in some way causing it. I don't know, I really don't.
No, yeah, there's hasn't been much research on that.
No, well, maybe there has, but I don't know.
There's been a bit of research around social media around the recent riots. And I forget now who it was, but I remember hearing this point that actually, because there was this whole idea that the riots were partly sort of encouraged by the use of BlackBerries, and that someone was making the comparison with the 2001 riots and saying, no, actually, that they spread just as fast then. That the technology isn't always the thing that it doesn't necessarily change what's going on. It might change the how we see it or how we perceive it's going on, but not necessarily actually how the news spreads or how quickly it spreads.
Very interesting. But we have to stop here, because I know that you need some coffee in order to go on and move on. So please stay with us at 4:30 or maybe 4:35. The next session will take place, and it will be on Greece. So it will be become more specific on the Greek case.
What time?
4. I'm sorry. Yes, 4:30. So in 10 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes. Is that right? Is it?
Yep.
Okay.
I see we've got a connection actually in terms of Christianity.
I had a question for you, but I'm afraid that I'm. You know what I was wondering?